Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
What does that say about our world if we are then subject to leadership, not from politicians and clergy and parents and educators, but MCs and DJs?
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 195, a talk with Bill Stefney. Bill grew up playing in bands, but found his real intro to the music business in college when he got involved in Adelphi University's radio station, WBAU. He became the music director as well as an on-air personality, overseeing a crew that included a young Chuck D, Flavor Flav, Dr. Dre, and more. Out of those connections, he became a key member of the legendary production collective, the Bomb Squad, best known for their game-changing work with Public Enemy. After college, Bill went to work as the first employee of a new record label called Def Jam, co-founded by his longtime friend Russell Simmons. Bill's job was to get the label's artists on the radio, something that sounds comparatively simple today, but was bordering on impossible back in 1985. After his time at Def Jam, Bill went on to found two record labels, produce albums for comedy legend Paul Mooney, act as music supervisor for movies like CB4 and Boomerang, and even partner with longtime friend Chris Rock on a humor newspaper for Howard University. We spoke to Bill at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's a guy who still has about a 179 average, Bill Stefney. Bill, thanks for coming by, Mr. Bill.
Mr. Bill, yeah,
Mr. Bill.
Indeed.
So you're wearing Adelphi University sweatshirt today?
Yeah, alma mater. The champion is good quality.
Yeah.
XXL.
So the very important activity you did there that I think, you know, maybe some of our listeners might know about and know about your history is, of course, the college bowling team.
Yeah.
So how is your game these days?
You know, I haven't been kegling in quite some time, in probably about 8 months. I've been having elbow issues, tennis elbow from literally playing too much tennis last spring. But I'm still good for about a 179.
Okay. Yeah. What was your average?
I averaged 185.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and we traveled. We traveled throughout the Northeast as an NCAA athlete. I can brag that I was. But then when you say, yeah, I was a bowler, you know, people look at you and say, oh, come on, dude, you look like a running back.
Did you do that all 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years. Yeah, I bowled.
Amazing. And, you know, one other thing you did at BAU, obviously, was get on the radio.
474757. Mr. Bill going to be with you till 1 o'clock, I think. I hope.
As a jockey and also as the program director, ultimately. So how'd you get into radio at first?
I always had a fascination for radio, a love for it. It probably comes from both of my parents, who are natives of Harlem and the Bronx. My late father, Ted Stefney, was a jazz musician. So in addition to the fact that he was a drummer growing up in Harlem, playing actually with a number of notables who came up at the same time, there was a television host, news host, named Gil Noble. He used to host a show called Like It Is, which was the African-American public affairs show on WABC-TV for decades.
Welcome to Like It Is. This edition will focus on the government surveillance of Malcolm X.
He was one of my father's teen friends, along with the great jazz saxophonist Jackie McLean. And they all grew up in pretty much the confluence of Harlem and Washington Heights in the 40s and 50s. So he was a musician.
Real Harlem native, you don't say the one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. So he, in addition to being such a great music fan and a fan of bop and swing and other forms of the genre, he listened to jazz radio. So when I came home in the afternoons, he worked at Sports Illustrated, sports magazine, actually, from their inception in 1954 up until 1989.
Bill's dad, Ted, was actually the first black editor of Sports Illustrated and features prominently in a story about an armed hijacking, the Queens Midtown Tunnel, and some undeveloped film for the magazine. Check out the show notes for a link to a letter from the SI publisher explaining all the details.
He would have Tuesdays and Wednesdays off because the magazine was issued on Tuesday morning. So they put it to bed on Monday night. It would go out. So that was their weekend, Tuesday and Wednesday. So I get home from school and what's blasting but WRVR jazz radio in New York during the 60s and 70s.
And don't forget, Monday night at midnight, WRVR premieres the new Sonny Fortune album, Infinity Years, and you can hear it without commercial interruption this Monday at midnight on 106.7.
Now, at that point, I hated jazz because that was my dad's music.
Sure.
Now, why do I want to hear Buddy Rich 15-minute drum solos? This is, just beyond me. But through osmosis and repetition, I think I developed a fascination for the sound of radio in general. And my mother was the quintessential mom listening to news radio in the morning, 1010 Winds and here in the city and 880 WCBS AM radio, just to hear the weather, the traffic, the headlines. She also grew up a Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra fan. So there are different stations at that point that would play the standards by Sinatra and Bennett and Nat King Cole. So, you know, we'd hear very melodic music from that era too in the morning. So it was in essence a radio sandwich between the two of them.
Right.
So that constant influence of having the radio on constantly in your household had an indelible effect, and I fell in love with it.
Wow. And was BAU the first station you worked at?
No. Ironically, my love for radio led to a scholarship to Adelphi University to study communications, a full ride sponsored by the National Urban League, the Long Island Urban League, and a radio station on Long Island, WLIR. They were a progressive rock radio station.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't sure if that LIR came before or after BAU. It was before?
Yeah, it was before for me. Mm-hmm. They put me through school. As I always tell it, in 1980, when I graduated from Hempstead High School, the Urban League and WLIR combined, along with Adelphi, to provide a scholarship to an African-American student in the tri-state area who could demonstrate via essay the importance of diversity in communications and media. So as it stood, and as I'll always say, they must have only received one essay because I won the contest.
Do you remember what the essay said? Got the scholarship.
That it's important that we have black people in media. So, that was compelling enough a thesis to get a full ride for 4 years at Adelphi. It was cool.
Wow. And you were at LIR for a bit. Who were Elton Spitzer and Zim Barstein?
Yeah, Elton Spitzer and Zim Barstein were respectively the owner and station manager, sales manager for WLIR and Phoenix Media. And they were the ones who put together the idea of the scholarship. And it was an interesting way that the scholarship was configured. In essence, it was a barter and trade relationship between WLIR and Adelphi University. Adelphi University would provide the scholarship, and in turn, WLIR would provide bartered advertising time for Adelphi on the radio station. And again, they gave it to this poor underserved young kid from Hempstead to go study communications there.
Yeah. What did you learn from those two guys in particular? I think they were the first people who kind of gave you a sense of the business side of music business.
Yeah, Elton and Zim gave me a sense of the importance of entrepreneurship early on. Mm-hmm. They ran a radio station. They owned a radio station. So as I entered the business and radio, just as a novice and as a student, yeah, I wanted to be a radio star. That's really all I knew. I wanted to be like one of those jocks that you heard during my days on WBLS FM in New York or WABC 77. I know Dre, when he was on here, he referenced WABC.
And before there was a WBLS, I always used to be a 77 WABC guy because I just liked the way they played music. And it was always popular hit music and stuff like that. And I was fascinated with, you know, every hit song that came out.
For a generation of us, WABC AM radio was the just perfect mixture of pop music because you could hear Fight the Power by the Isley Brothers. And When We Get Behind Closed Doors by Charlie Rich, you know, it just next to one another. Just a hodgepodge of music that works. So to find a circumstance, a place that could play your favorite music, and then you get paid for it on an everyday basis and have a career, that it doesn't get better than that. And then on WBLS, the program director and chief personality was a guy named Frankie Crocker, who...
This is definitely many people who grew up in New York around the time you did reference him.
Well, yeah, he was it. He was the star. He was the godhead.
107.5 FM.
I'm Frankie Crocker. You know who you are, I trust. And we hope it's a good afternoon for you. We opened up with New York, New York from Frank Sinatra here on WBLS.
For all of us, if Frankie Crocker ain't on your radio ain't really on. We want it to be... There was no Eddie Murphy yet. There was no Spike Lee yet. You know, our big stars were older. Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, we couldn't really relate to them in the way that we could relate to somebody who was just so cool and smooth. Yeah. So Frankie was it. And I think being a fan of Frankie, WABC, and the radio sandwich from my parents then sort of coagulates to then connect me to the WLIR scholarship. And, you know, it just became history.
And then you realize there's a larger business outside of the guy behind the microphone.
Yeah. Yeah. That you didn't just have to be Frankie Crocker.
Yeah.
That, as Elton and Zim said, you could be the owner of the radio station that Frankie Crocker broadcast from. That was a more important position and a more sustainable position for a career. At that time, that was the premise.
Interesting. And during all this, you were a guitar player, a bass player?
Yeah, I was a guitar, bass player, occasional drummer, occasional keyboardist.
Okay. How serious did you take all of that?
I was fairly serious because of my age, you know, being born in the early 60s. You know, I sort of sit chronologically on the precipice between the big, gigantic R&B group era of Earth, Wind & Fire and Slave and BT Express and Kool & the Gang. And DJs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a few of us who were still in high school and in musicians and were musicians playing in bands when the turntable started to arrive. So, you know, there's like a duality for some of us, not just one of those guys.
Interesting. Did you see, could you actually see your bookings like go down on the weekends, you
know, oh, yeah.
week by week as DJs yeah. became more popular?
Absolutely. You know, around 77, 78. You could still, as a young band of teenagers covering the latest in R&B and soul, you could still get a basement gig or a wedding. By 79, 80, that really starts to dry up. And again, the turntables arrive.
Wow. So tell me about BAU, because it was such an interesting collective of people who went on to do such amazing things. How did that crew sort of first come together that would center around BAUU and Spectrum City and Dre and all of those people, you know, from that crew?
Yeah. First off, during my time at Adelphi and at WLIR and at WBAU, I was still a fan of the Long Island music scene and what was at that point a developing local hip-hop scene based on mobile DJing. And the key mobile DJ crew for that era was a group called Spectrum City, led by Hank Shockley. They used to call him the president. And a collection of other MCs and guys who carried equipment and were hangers on, you know, various roles and capacities within the crew. So they threw the best parties on Long Island. They were, in my view, and for some of us, we felt that they were better than the traveling DJ crews that would come from the city, come from Brooklyn, come from Queens, even come from the Bronx. So being such a big fan of Spectrum, attending Adelphi, just so happens one day I'm walking around the campus. I'm going to go get lunch at the University Center. I'd get my daily lunch, which, you know, I pay for to this day in medication, which was an Adelphi cheeseburger, fries, a Dr. Pepper, and I don't know if you remember the Chipwich. Chipwich was a cookie with ice cream in the middle of it. So. Yeah. You know, to have that every single day, you know, we didn't have the dietary warnings as prominent back then as we do now, but, you know, certainly it was enjoyable as it went down. So as I'm munching into my Chipwich, finishing off my meal somewhere, I think it's the end of 81, early 82, I see a guy in a silk Spectrum City jacket, which I couldn't believe. How could somebody so cool be at a place as so uncool as the Ruth S. Harley University Center at Adelphi University? It just makes no sense. I must be dreaming or, you know, hallucinating. Maybe it's the Chipwich. So I do go up to the guy and I say, hey, you're from Spectrum. I see you have a Spectrum jacket on. And he introduces himself as a student at Adelphi, a graphic arts student by the name of Carlton Ridenour. And he's one of the MCs, too, for the crew. And he knew about the small developing hip-hop show that I was doing on BAU. And we struck a chord. I invited not only him, but the entire Spectrum crew to come up and hang out on my Monday evening show. And that's where we, in essence, all connect.
Wow. And that was the Mr. Bill show.
That was the Mr. Bill show.
Mr. Bill Hightower.
And at what point did you realize, hey, we have to make songs for this thing? And you come up with, you know, N41.
Yeah. You know what Busters is, man?
Yo, it's N41, my brother.
I'm going to pick up a package on the way, man. Yeah, man.
75.
Anybody got change for a dollar?
Yeah, man.
Can I have a transfer, please?
Yeah, but you can't be smoking no cigarettes. And you guys in the back, you can't play
those
boxes.
Shut up, man. Yo, man, I paid $300 for my box, man.
I
want to hear Mr. Bill, man.
I want to hear Bob.
Townhouse 3, man. Yo. Yo,
brother.
Rock the box, man.
Fresh from the back of the N41 was a tribute to the N41 bus line that went from Roosevelt, Long Island to Hempstead, Long Island, and was the very first song made as a promo for Bill's show on WBAU. It features Spectrum City, Butch Cassidy, Chuck D, then going by Chucky D, and the Townhouse 3, a group that would later become Son of Berserk. This track doesn't exist anywhere, but Bill was able to find us a copy, and if you'd like to hear the full 8 minutes, just become a patron by the end of April 2017 at patreon.com/thecyphershow, and you'll get it in the May bonus episode.
And my name is Chucky D, y'all.
Public Enemy number one, and all of the songs that started as like station covers, essentially.
I didn't come up with it. Each crew and artist who would come through locally, they all turned into homages, not to me, but really to the show. And I think also to the concept and prospect of Black Long Island, Nassau County, having its own radio station. You know, WBLS was a New York thing, was big, it's owned by Percy Sutton.
Percy Sutton was, in addition to an owner of WBLS, a prominent civil rights activist, a freedom rider, the lawyer for Malcolm X, an Eagle Scout, an intelligence officer with the Tuskegee Airmen, the Manhattan Borough president from 1966 to 1977, and an investor in the Apollo Theater.
And then the large corporation and some of the other radio stations were all distant, whereas WBAU was something local that they could relate to. And I think they were just so passionate about having something so close that they'd go into either their basements or bedrooms and create something for us.
Yeah. And so somewhere around this time, as you're starting the radio, you meet a fast-talking kid from Queens. I think it was like 81. Russell.
Well, yeah, I am.
How did you meet him?
I actually met Russell through LIR. So I'm working at WLIR. Again, it's progressive rock at that point, freeform rock to an extent. And to sort of explain, prior to the rigid formatting of professional commercial radio, DJs essentially played their own music based on their personal tastes. So for rock radio stations, there was even that much more freedom to choose what you played as a jock. So WLIR was one of those stations, and actually one of the last holdouts for that sort of freeform music programming. As it turned out, some of the coolest developing music from a domestic standpoint and from an import standpoint would come through WLIR. So you're hearing The Clash, you're hearing U2 as imports on LIR. You're hearing the Sex Pistols, and so much new music and new expressions coming through that you start to develop a taste for that world. So I started to connect more to the downtown New York City music scene, connected with one of the editors through LIR for, I believe it was the New York Rocker magazine.
New York Rocker was founded by Alan Bedrock in 1976, and it ran for 55 issues until 1982, and was very briefly revived 2 years later.
And there was an upcoming show with Curtis Blow that they actually looked for a correspondent to cover. So the editor, or one of the editors, had come through LIR, said, would you be interested in writing for us? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll definitely do it. Well, here's a number for Curtis Blow's manager. So I call out to this guy. Now, as I always tell folks, it was an interesting meeting on the phone, in that when I reached out to Russell, I think I had Russell, S-I-M-O-N-S, so it's Russell Simons. So Russell has, at least for that period, very thick New York, almost ethnic accent. It sounded like many of the folks that I grew up with on Long Island who came from Great Neck or Roslyn. So then on the other side, it's Bill Stefney, which in the last name Stefney doesn't give, it's a rare name, so it doesn't give an immediate sign as to who that person could be. So, and naturally, people tend to say that I sound like a combination of a Long Islander and a Midwestern anchorman. So you have these two guys who are talking on the phone, Russell, the ethnic New Yorker, and Bill, the Midwestern white guy on the other side. We both thought the other guy was white until we met. So, the relationship, in essence, starts off, on a pretty bizarre level,
right?
To begin with. And I do get to interview Curtis Blow. I don't remember what happened to the New York Rocker piece that I wrote. I know it's not online, but I think I did write it when I started doing BAU some years later. I had stayed in contact with Russell, and he talked about a project he was doing with his little brother, didn't know what it was, and that turned out to be, of course, Run DMC.
Run DMC, of course. And this is one of the things about your time at BAU, is you got groups so early down to the station for interviews. You had Run DMC, obviously. You had the Beasties. You guys had even the Fat Boys, I think, right before they changed their name.
Yeah, yeah. They were the Disco 3 when they came.
Oh, they still had their old name when they came.
Yeah, they had their old name.
Oh, wow. So you get a group like, say, Run DMC. It's your friend's little brother and his two neighbors or whatever. Do you have a sense that they're going to be big, or that there was anything notable about them?
No. The interesting thing is, you look back on it, and by virtue of the rearview mirror, you can see guys who are now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But even when you see them on TV accepting you know, an award for meritorious service for 30 years in music, you still see teenagers who are just very, very creative, who had boundless energy. I think if I can remember anything distinct and perhaps a thread in between Chuck, Flavor, LL, Run D, Jay, Spider D, you know, the Fat Boys, all these folks who came through, just boundless energy, enthusiasm, and optimism. And I think that's what hip-hop was during that era, that, you know, it's the Reagan era, and times are becoming immediately difficult, but we're also the beneficiaries of folks who came before us, that, you know, we weren't living during slavery, mm-hmm. we weren't living during Jim Crow, and even later on, we're before crack. I always say that it's sort of an air pocket that we had, attitudinally, creatively, also where you could just do stuff, and you really felt that you could accomplish that. The non-hip-hop music of that era, just D-Train, you know, Keep On, Ain't No Stopping Us Now, McFadden and Whitehead, it was supremely optimistic mm-hmm. for folks who were, again, the first or even second generation beneficiaries of the fights of the 50s and 60s.
Right, and that whole generation of Black creatives or people you would make your career with, even outside of music, right? The, you know, Nelson George, Chris Rock.
Spike Lee. Yeah, yeah. There's a great photo that Nelson George developed a small film off of called Brooklyn Boheme.
My name is Nelson George. I was fortunate to be part of an amazing community of Black and Hispanic artists who innovated as writers, filmmakers, actors, musicians, photographers, designers, and spoken word artists.
Where a bunch of us got together in 1989 to take a photo for what was going to be a cover story for the New York Times Sunday magazine called The New Black Aesthetic. And, you know, you just see all these folks who are in this photo. It includes Russell, Run, Chris Rock, Nelson George, me, George Wolfe, Spike, Vernon Reid, Fab Five Freddy, Alva Rogers, you know, all sorts of great people. And you, again, think of that generation and just the notion that there weren't too many boundaries or barriers mm-hmm. for us to accomplish whatever we wanted to attempt to accomplish.
Yeah. So there's this interesting kind of bubble period in your career that I only came across, you know, digging, and heard Chuck talk about, or read Chuck talk about, which is like maybe 85, 86. I don't know if this is pre-Def Jam or you're already at Def Jam, but before Public Enemy really took off, when it seemed rather than going into recorded music, your crew was going to do syndicated radio, and maybe there were going to be sponsors involved, and, you know, Swatch and all these people might actually enable you to take BAU commercial.
Yeah, we made several attempts and created a number of demos for radio syndicators. Didn't get too many bites. I'm also an editor at the CMJ New Music Report. I was their beatbox editor doing mm-hmm. urban music and hip-hop music. I think we had the first national chart of tracking hip-hop music as it was played on college radio and weekend mix shows in the CMJ New Music Report. So I'm doing that in 1984-85. There was a small, low-power UHF television station. Actually, there are two stations, channels 59 and 63, out of Huntington, Long Island. And I produced a show called Word.
The World, music video show.
Yeah, The World of Rock and Dance. And yeah. Chuck was actually one of our hosts. on that show, along with a comedian named Steve O.
The freaks come out at night. Well, either that or they're here in the studio working with me, which, by the way, as we near the end of another Word program, besides wanting to thank all the wonderful people that sit in their homes or wherever they happen to be sitting, watching, or standing, watching this show, I want to thank them. I also want to thank the wonderful people that make this thing happen here in the studio. When I say make this thing happen, it sounds a lot more difficult than it really is. No, it is a very difficult thing that they do, and they do a fine job of it, and that's Karen is in the other room, and Bill, and of course, Mr. Bill, our producer, and Chuck D has been on the telephones all night.
Yes, that's the Chuck D working the telephones, taking your requests. Bill went all the way to his storage unit to find this clip for us. Steve O's full name is Steve Oakes and is fortunately not the guy from Jackass. Here's a taste of his comedy from the early 90s.
Thank you very much. How you doing? Good, good. My name is Steve O. A lot of people wonder how I got the name. Very simple. I was on Wheel of Fortune. I bought a vowel. I kept it. It's my real name, actually. It's my real name. I got it at birth. Before that, I was embryo.
Went on to win, I think, like 4 episodes of Star Search. It was our version of the popular video shows of that time, quite local. One of those deals where you think, all right, so we'll continue to do this. Maybe it'll grow into something else on another platform, using the term that we would use today, or we'll just continue to have fun. So I was doing a whole bunch of things, and I was interviewing for radio gigs. And I had gotten offered 2 gigs. One was to do radio sales at WYNY 97.1, which was sort of an adult contemporary pop radio station in New York City during that era, playing Elton John or Air Supply or Christopher Cross, Sailing, Take Me Away. So there was that, and that was actually good pay. I believe that starting salary.
Wow, that's that Air Supply money.
Yeah, Air Supply. I think that was $40,000 to start.
In 83, 84.
In 1984, 85.
That'd be almost $94,000 today.
Wow. And I'm like 22 years old. So that's one.
It's all the money in the world.
I mean, I thought I was Onassis with that, with that offer. So there was that. And then there was an interview at WRKS Kiss FM. With the 2 guys, Barry Mayo and Tony Quaterone, who ran what was the growing urban station in New York at that time, the competitor to WBLS, to come in as assistant music director. No pay, but I'd be a 21, 22-year-old assistant music director for, you know, one of the top urban radio stations in the country. So, you know, you're just thinking of those 2 options. Towards the end of 1985, I had already known Rick Rubin. Obviously, I knew Russell Simmons already for 4 years. They are about to embark on their partnership with CBS Records for Def Jam.
In the fall of 1985, Def Jam and Columbia Records announced that they were partnering to distribute Def Jam's releases in the U.S. We'll link to Columbia's press release about the partnership in the show notes.
And they made me a cultural offer that I couldn't refuse. Not a monetary one,
right?
But certainly a cultural one.
That was actually one of the things I wanted to get to, is you were, as far as I understand, literally the first paid employee at Def Jam.
You know, that's subject to debate. The great George Jakulius. We're from the station to Aunt Julius. I brought a hot
dog. From who, George Jakulius? George Jakulius met Rick Rubin while both were studying at NYU and was around for the rise of Def Jam. And when Rubin went west to form Def American, George went with him. Jakulius went on to sign and produce acts like the Jayhawks and the Black Crowes, and also has produced for artists like Beck, Tom Petty, Joan Jett, Screaming Trees, Jude, Soul Asylum, Primal Scream, and even Bob Dylan and the Wu-Tang Clan.
Worked for Rick. I don't know if he got paid. Mm-hmm. He was doing stuff for him.
Yeah.
And then another executive named Gary Harris, who's a longtime, well-known promotions guy, worked for Def Jam prior to me. I don't know if Gary got paid, but I did somehow finagle a salary out of Russell and Rick during those early days.
Amazing. And so, as far as I understand it, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, your job was basically radio-centric, trying to convince radio stations to play Def Jam, which, you know, Bill Adler always says was much tougher than his job of getting white press to write about hip-hop. Trying to get white radio, black radio to play hip-hop was tough. What were some of your tricks? What would you tell program directors to be like, well, I know you don't play rap, but...
Well, you know, and Bill Adler pays me an incredible compliment when he says that, but, you know, I had the best excuse in the world because so few radio stations would play hip-hop. I could always go back to Russell and Rick and say, you know what, look, they don't play hip-hop. Right. There's nothing that can be done. But yeah, you would find ways. And I I believed that during that era, from my BAU experience, that focusing just on the big radio station to get our music played was a mistake, because there are so many other ways that you could expose music virally, you know, during that era. It's the period of the Ghetto Blaster, of the Box. Each one of those, in my view, was a radio transmitter. Station. Yeah. That just walking down Frederick Douglass Boulevard, there's going to be some young brother playing it so loudly that, you know, within a radius of perhaps a quarter of a mile, you could hear Good Times or, you know, whatever the popular song was of the day. So getting those cassettes to those tastemakers on the street, vitally important, as well as super serving what was the growing alternative universe of radio stations late at night playing hip hop.
So at what point does the production collective called the Bomb Squad come together? And first off, I guess, did you call yourselves the Bomb Squad, or was that sort of a name put on afterwards?
Yeah, I think Hank came up with Bomb Squad. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Keith, when he was here, said who came up with it, but I think Hank came up with it.
Who was in it? I know the personnel, you know, shifted somewhat over the years.
The first assemblage would be the production team for the first Public Enemy album,
right?
Yo Bum Rush the Show. So that starts off with Hank, Chuck, Eric Sadler, Flavor, and me.
Mm-hmm.
After the success of Public Enemy's first album, critically, not commercially, an executive by the name of Ed Eckstein from Polygram Mercury Records came to me at a convention and said, you know, you guys did a fantastic job on Public Enemy. And, you know, I have to commend you. And Ed is a musician. He's the son of the legendary Billy Eckstein, jazz vocalist. His godmother was Sarah Vaughan. So to get a compliment like that just meant everything in the world. He told us that he had just scored his own label deal under his own logo called Wing Records through Mercury, and he had signed the former Miss America, Vanessa Williams.
That's how the remixes came about.
Yeah, and that's how the remixes come. And, of course, we're all fans of Vanessa. She was beautiful. She was, you know, from our period and our time, and even her family. She's not from Long Island, but I believe she has family from Long Island. So, you know, there's familiarity there. So me, Hank, and Eric Peeloff. Chuck is Public Enemy. He's traveling, you know, throughout the country as Public Enemy is growing in stature and in importance. So musically and production-wise, Hank, Eric Sadler, and me, we're left to work on the Vanessa Williams project. So we remix her first two singles. They're very R&B in orientation. The first one, The Right Stuff, and the second one, He's Got the Look. Both become very big hits.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of rap producers remixing R&B records becomes really prominent, I think, initially with our work on those projects.
Yeah, and you obviously did. You know, I talked to Keith about this a little bit, the Belle Biv DeVoe stuff, which weren't remixes, those were album cuts.
The Bomb Squad produced three songs on BBD's Quintuple Platinum debut album, and as you can hear on our episode with Keith Shockley, also remixed the hit Poison into the version we know and love.
Those were albums, and that comes later. And that's actually when Keith, who had been an original member of Spectrum City and Hank's brother, comes back to the fold and comes back to produce.
Right. And so that early Bomb Squad, the kind of Yo Bum Rush the Show era, what was your role specifically? Like, what was kind of the production process?
Hank and Chuck essentially produced and composed most of the music for the album in the local Spectrum City studio in Hempstead. Mm-hmm. The idea was then to translate those productions into something more commercial, releasable. So we bring those demos into what was then INS Recording Studios in Lower Manhattan, and working with the team and taking pretty good music background. I also studied at Adelphi audio recording, and I'll give him a shout out. Don Muro was our professor, great electronic musician and teacher of recording technique. So I had been assigned with the task of taking Chuck really and turning him into a superstar recording artist on the same level of LL and Run. And, I took that mission seriously. So you take on the tasks of overseeing the production from a budgeting standpoint to then also working along with the guys from a vision a standpoint, from an overall creative musical signature process. What do we sound like? How do we differentiate? Who are we musically? So that when you come on the radio at that point or on the box, that immediately folks know who you are.
Yeah. And by the second album, you had that on lock. I remember hearing stuff from the second album on the radio when it was out on, a college station or whatever was playing it. And, so distinctive by Nation of Millions, I think, the sound that you guys had.
Yeah, we didn't figure it out immediately that the annoying tone that existed on really the first demo, Public Enemy number one with Chuck and Flavor, that was actually a promo for Dr. Dre's radio show.
Yeah, the kind of whiny.
Yeah. That could become a signature. It would, hip hop, as it goes from being really disco and the melodies of disco. To being non-melodic, just basic beat. It's like that Sucker MC's. 2 years ago, a friend of mine asked me to say some MC rhyme. So I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The rhyme was there, but then it went this way. To then noise as, a level of anti-melody that, no one really could perceive of. That's annoying but compelling at the same time.
Yeah. As a sort of one of the things that was emblematic of that era of production for you guys was the sample from The Grunt.
Yep. Yes, the
rhythm, the rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhyme. Whose idea was that? Do you remember?
Not sure. I give again credit to Chuck and Hank being, in the Spectrum City studio and having such a massive record collection and having such a great sense of those riffs. Mm-hmm. That came from those JB's records.
Yeah, incredible. By the time Fear of a Black Planet came out, I know you are credited as, I think, an executive producer on that record, but the day-to-day actual production of it, I don't think you had that much to do with, right? You kind of pulled back.
No, I had to. We were getting complaints from other artists at Def Jam that Public Enemy is starting to gain traction. And isn't that because Mr. Bill spends all of his time, on Public Enemy, which I didn't think I did, but
that was a perception.
Sure. And perception can be real. Mm-hmm. So I made the very definite decision to say, look, where is my future going to go? For my career, am I going to be a producer? And, I like the studio. I'm a musician. This is, great, I'm realizing a dream, but the notion of running a business, going back to Elton Spitzer and Zim Barsting at WLIR, they always said, they're on my shoulder saying, but really, running a business, don't forget, That's the most important. You don't want to be Frankie Crocker. You want to be the own the radio station Frankie Crocker's on. Well, do I want to be the hot wearing sunglasses at night hip hop producer, or do I want to be the CEO or even an owner of a label one day mm-hmm. where that producer works? So I guess, you know, by my past, what was already inculcated in me, mm-hmm. I made the choice to stick with being an executive.
One of the things that fascinates me about sort of the first three records or so of Public Enemy is this idea, and I remember definitely this impression around them circa like 88, especially around Chuck, was that they weren't just a group, that they somehow had the answers for race, for Black America, right? They sort of had this air around them and this set of expectations on them, Chuck in particular. And so I guess my, you know, sort of a twofold question, what was that like for you as someone in that circle and making that music? And second, did you get a sense of what that was like for Chuck?
Well, yeah, we were know-it-alls, definitely, that we were the college kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps that differentiates us from other folks who came out of the quote-unquote hip-hop experience, that we were audacious in our intellect. Like, all right, yeah, we are the smart guys, and we know we have the answers to everything. Mm-hmm. So, and that was like a marketing hook in many instances. So, yeah, I think, you know, using that certainly gives you something to hold on to from a marketing point of view. But there is a trap, because then people expect you to have the answer and you have to be right at the same time.
Right. I guess that's the issue. And, you know, we've talked to a few people who were around about Griff and about the Washington Times thing, you know, the interview.
As we also discussed in episode 191 with Faith Newman, in March 1989, Professor Griff, PE's road manager, said some pretty awful anti-Semitic things to the right-wing trash rag Washington Times, causing an uproar that even had Chuck D temporarily disband the group.
I guess the narrative that's grown up around that and around his comments and about how the band reacted to it, the sort of narrative in the popular imagination is it wasn't even the interview that was so bad. It was specifically Chuck D being indecisive and, you know, I'm not saying anything, I'm defending him, he's out of the group, he's in, I'm disbanding the group, whatever. And in some ways, it has come to be seen that indecisiveness is what damaged Public Enemy. Is that, in your mind, accurate?
I think people are very hard on Chuck and on the group in those assumptions. The notion of, and this is the pitfalls of taking on all that ails the world, musically, and the theory that musicians will lead us in that way, we bought into it. I think it then becomes the pressure from taking on, you know, the world and being, you know, the answer button for every issue, racially, sexually, economically. Those pressures in general created a crucible for Chuck. Mm-hmm. But isn't there a point where we can step back and say, but, you know, he's really an MC and he's a rapper. You know, even if they're saying they have the answers, you got to be kidding me. And what does that say about our world if we are then subject to leadership, not from politicians and clergy and parents and educators, but MCs and DJs? So I think on all sides, not just Chuck by himself, but all of us, the smart guys, always, you know, presenting themselves as having all of the answers. That's on one side. And then the reception to that of people thinking that we do have the answers. So when, you know, you're a musician who doesn't navigate those difficulties in a very hot time, again, that crucible, then, you know, the criticism grows. I don't think it was warranted, at least the level that it rose to. I don't think the pressures that developed were warranted. Those pressures that were there put forth on Chuck.
Mm-hmm. One final sort of PE thing of that era. You were on the set of one of my favorite videos of all time, Night of the Living Bassheads. I saw a photo of you on that set.
Yeah. I did. my role was writing actually the script. For everything. For PETV.
In today's edition of PETV News, we'll explore the devastating effects drugs are having on our society in what is now termed the base hit syndrome. We'll also feature the controversial group Public Enemy and their new album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which is causing a ruckus everywhere.
You know, we're all throwing ideas around, and we had to get a script to Lionel Martin and Ralph McDaniels, and we're just coming up with ideas right there. And
on the set.
On the set, right, you know, right there in the night before.
Amazing. So how did Soul Records come about? Why did you and Hank decide, okay, we're going to split off from this and start a label?
It was actually Hank, Chuck, and Bill. It was Hank, Chuck, and me initially. I had gotten to a point at Def Jam after Rick Rubin left in 1988. He moves out to California to essentially restart his career and take the notion of Def into a different direction. So Rick wanted me to come out to LA.
As did the Beastie Boys.
And well, the Beastie Boys actually wanted me to manage them
directly,
you know, before they even moved out to LA. So, you know, I'm fielding different offers because Def Jam was incredibly successful. We were all young guys. Rick and Russell were the owners, but, you know, there is a split happening, divergence. Rick is going out to LA after producing the soundtrack to the film Lesson Zero. Russell is, you know, as visionary as he had always been as a manager, as a label owner. He's looking at some other entertainment opportunities, including in comedy.
Right.
So, yeah, I had to figure out what my future would be. Got offered to work with Rick. Got offered to manage the Beasties. Jerry Moss and Herb Alpert, the A&M of A&M Records.
Yeah.
John McLean, who was the head of black music for A&M, was moving over to Interscope. So they were looking for a head of black music there. So I got interviewed for that gig. Chris Blackwell, Island Records, was looking for someone to run black music. So I interviewed for that gig as well. So trying to figure out what I'm going to do. Once again, Elton Spitzer and Zim Barstein are on my shoulders. Well, you know, do you want to get a gig or will you look for an opportunity where you can own something? So at the same time that I'm talking to A&M Records about a gig, I actually run into Jimmy Iovine, who I had met previously when he produced an album called A Very Special Christmas, which was a fundraiser for the Special Olympics.
Run DMC was on.
That's where I meet Jimmy. So I run into him at the A&M studios as I'm out meeting with Rick. I'm out meeting with the A&M guys. And Jimmy says, well, you know, we are putting together Interscope Records, and you know, this is actually prior to Interscope. Jimmy's forming a partnership with Irving Azoff to create this huge, super mega music label. Irving Azoff was the chairman of MCA Records, and was at that point considered the most prominent music executive in the business. Jimmy, as a producer of Bruce Springsteen, of John Lennon, of U2, considered the premier rock music producer of the era. And that they're going to form this super team. They are also going to, when they put together this music conglomerate, they're going to bring in three music production partnerships: LA and Babyface, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and the Bomb Squad. So all of these guys are going to be in one big, gigantic, you know, mega ship to take over music. And that's Jimmy. He is Mr. Vision in that regard.
And that didn't end up happening, obviously.
Did not happen.
Yeah.
So Jimmy and Irving are working out their partnership. Meanwhile, I had left Def Jam already, trying to find a gig. Money's getting tight. Chuck and Hank also want to figure out what they're going to do with their careers. So the three of us sit down and say, you know what, we're going to do a label together. We'll do it with Jimmy. We'll go with him. and we'll just be part of this mega music conglomerate. That doesn't happen. Jimmy tells us to sign to MCA Records while he's working on his partnership. So we actually signed a deal with MCA Records to do a label. Mm-hmm. The Jimmy Irving thing doesn't work out. So we're still at MCA Records with our label deal. The pressures of running Public Enemy, being an artist, and also some of the residual effect of the Griff situation put a lot of pressure on Chuck. So he removes himself from the label partnership. So in essence, it becomes actually Hank and Bill doing a label deal with MCA Records. What had initially been really, again, Jimmy Iovine, Irving Azoff, the Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, L.A. Babyface, and the Bomb Squad somehow gets filtered and reduced down to Bill.
To two guys in MCA. Yeah, right.
At MCA Records.
Right.
Yeah, and that's where Soul Records comes from.
And it didn't last very long. It was only about a year before you and Hank split up. What led to you guys splitting up? Or I guess he bought out your interest in the label. Or...
Yeah, he did buy out my interest in the label. It's one of those partnerships that just didn't work out. You know, I think we were all used to working together in a larger collective, mm-hmm. which included Chuck, which included Eric Sadler, which then included Keith as well. And even going back to our BAU days, it included Dre, included Flavor. So when that got boiled down to the two of us, it was sort of like, you know, a family that had you know, all sorts of members. And I guess, you know, there's an empty nest syndrome going where it's now just the two parents are left and now all they can do is stare at one another. So, you know, a lot of times those partnerships don't work out and the parents move forward. I think that's what happened with us.
One of the interesting groups you had during your time as a label head, obviously, was Young Black Teenagers, who were not particularly young and not black.
The Young Black Teenagers was an all-white group made up of Cameron, Firstborn, Tommy Never, and DJ Scribble. While they intended their name as a tribute to the hip-hop culture they loved, it didn't go over well in many quarters, even landing them on VH1's list of least hip-hop moments.
You never seemed fully convinced of their shtick if you read sort of interviews with you contemporaneously. What were your feelings about them as you were putting their records out?
Well, you know, I liked them. I thought they did great music. I thought they were legitimate rappers, you know, working with the Bomb Squad. But we knew that we were going to run into all sorts of opposition. We had seen it from the Beastie Boys. Yeah, I can go back to doing a panel at Howard University at the height of the Beasties, 1987, with a bunch of activists and musicians, and I got pilloried. How dare you, you know, destroy the history and legacy of black music by being associated with people who are going to be credited with creating hip-hop, black culture, black people. It's just, you know, completely over the top. So always having that in mind and understanding also the temperature of the times, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, much of it informed by the work of Public Enemy, along with X-Clan, along with KRS-One, along with Poor Righteous Teachers, that, you know, the notions of race and hip-hop were very distinct and very overt mm-hmm. at that point. So now the guys who, you know, sort of launched that revolution come back with a bunch of white kids from Queens and Brooklyn, you know, which is, again, the smart guys, always smarter than everybody, you know, trying to mess with people. So, I think it is Hank who comes up with the name Young Black Teenagers to, again, you know, sort of create a punk-like notion, a new wave punk-like notion, ironic name mm-hmm. to get folks to talk about the band, but also to make a statement as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And, you know, you also, you had Son of Berserk.
We had Son of Berserk, and Berserk himself was one of the rappers we had from WBAU.
Right.
T.A. the DJ from the Townhouse 3, who had a great voice. Many folks did compare him to Chuck when they heard him. Down like an elevator, you know I got to make it feel funky for you. Yo, it's the beat that we're rolling with a what? Show no pity for punk.
cause you're faking the funk. Reach me the mic and I'll recite, and I'm not the herb or the one to be tipped. Take my advice, brother.
We thought that T.A., along with the rest of the group, the full name was Son of Berserk, featuring No Self Control and the Band, B-A-N-N-E-D. Again, it's the, you know, the smart guys,
right?
They're doing interesting things.
And the record is amazing, but it never really blew up, right, in the way that you might expect a Public Enemy affiliated project of that era that is that good to succeed. Was it just, oh, they are using that Ice Cube beat, the confusion over that? Was that sort of the sole thing that held them back, or was it something else?
And the story, I don't know if this has been discussed already, that beat was actually a Son of Berserk beat before it was an Ice Cube beat. But because it was, you know, such a great beat, and the pressure was on the Bomb Squad to deliver for Ice Cube, that the beat actually went to him for America's Most Wanted.
Ice Cube with the lynch mob, I got it going on. A nigga that's living in the city of the criminal zone. One time can't keep the law in order, cause everybody's going crazy, so poor.
Hard to understand, a hell of a man. My man 50 grand, don't stop the ice, they win. Turn the volume up to 10.
Yeah, we were always subject to our backgrounds as Long Island guys who not only came from the Long Island hip hop scene, but also came from the alternative music scene, punk, and other influences. So, you know, we made creative decisions artistically that really, you know, had less to do with whether or not something was going to be commercial, but whether or not somebody was going to talk about it, mm-hmm. it was going to be interesting, it was going to make a statement. So whether it was Young Black Teenagers or Son of Berserk, you know, we thought that we were being creative.
Okay. And one of the things you did outside of, you know, recorded music was you moved into movies, music supervising movies, which, you know, I assume started with the Juice soundtrack, or maybe perhaps before, but
I guess
there was Fight the Power, and then the soundtrack.
Well, actually, it starts with helping out with Tougher Than Leather.
Oh, okay.
Which is a Run DMC movie that, for some reason, I don't see it anywhere. You know, it's like, you know, you go on Netflix or, you know, any other place, and you never really see Tougher Than Leather on cable or anything. So Tougher Than Leather was a movie starring Run, DMC, the late great Jam Master Jay, and Rick Rubin. It was a combination.
It's like a Three Stooges.
Because Rick was a fan of the Three Stooges and thought that they were high art, there were elements of the Three Stooges, of, you know, French Impressionism, of blaxploitation. Loosely interpreted, it was a mess.
Y'all stupid or something, man? Y'all late again, man.
Nah, Jay had a fight outside, man. It was an accident.
Nah, I ain't had no accident. That kid outside, he had an accident. Right, he was popping that week.
Nah, he just asked you about your hat.
It's the way he asked me.
True.
So, like, a Muslim right down the steps.
Shut up.
So, there was actually a soundtrack done for the film and music that was attached to the film that later became Tougher Than Leather album. That Run DMC put out. So, I participated with that, actually some of the coordination musically for Tougher Than Leather.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was my first experience film music-wise. Then it moves over to my connections with Spike Lee,
right?
For Do the Right Thing.
And, you know, one of the movies you worked on was CB4. So I was really hoping for maybe some insight into the creation of the masterpiece that is I'm Black, Y'all.
And I'm black, y'all. And I'm black, y'all. And I'm blacker than black. And I'm black, y'all. I'm blickety black, blacker than black, black. I'm blacker than black, yo. Because I'm black and I'm black.
Yo, I'm black. Was there any insight other... No, I'm black, I'm black. I think it's written by Nelson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Of having Alan Payne just mocking Public Enemy, to be honest with you. So, yeah, I remember being in the studio. Daddy O from Stetson Sonic was our co-music producer
mm-hmm.
for all of the tracks for CB4. But, you know, everything came out of the minds of both Nelson and Chris, who were, you know, again, so great to work with, because In addition to the fact that Nelson had come up through the business with Russell.
Right.
His roommate, you know, contemporary, you know, best friends. Working with Chris was a benefit because he was such a fan. He's a fan of the music. He carried crates for DJ crews. So the mocking of the music and the culture came from a point of love more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And that's obviously not the only time you would work with Chris. You still do stuff with him to this day. How did you guys meet? Do you remember?
We were introduced by Nelson George.
Mm-hmm.
I had moved to Brooklyn in 1987 by virtue of Nelson's introduction of the neighborhood Fort Greene in Clinton Hill. And Chris, as he's developing his stand-up career, also lived in the area. And we all just really formed a crew of creatives who lived in the area, were of the same age, mm-hmm. who had basically the same interests, similar points of views, just all hanging out.
And what about your partnership with him has kind of kept it going? You guys did the humor paper for Howard, you know, summer program.
Bill and Chris developed the summer school program in association with Comedy Central and Viacom. One of the program's alumni is Donald Glover.
What was your working relationship like with him that it kind of kept going this
well,
long?
If you would ask him, he would say that the reason why he chose to work with me for the Howard Project was that I was his only close friend with his own office. That was the only qualification. Beyond that, you know, there was no other reasoning. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, has tremendous vision. I'm always amazed at just how his mind works, that it's not a brain, it's a processor.
Yeah.
And when you're working with somebody who you don't know, because their thought process is not as linear as the average human being, it's just, you know, a fascinating experience to be a part of. So he wanted to create an opportunity for young people of color to write and produce comedy, because when he was on Saturday Night Live, he didn't get on too much because all the writers were white. And
not an unreasonable Freudian slip there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, all the writers were right, right? No, but and let me slow down. All the comedy writers for his era on Saturday Night Live were white, and they couldn't write for him or from his experience, so he couldn't get before the cameras. So he said, you know what? I noticed that the writing staff at SNL, most of them came from the Harvard Lampoon. What if we created the Harvard Lampoon at Howard University? And that idea became
Iltop came from.
The Iltop, which then moved over to a project with Comedy Central.
Interesting. And so, you know, speaking of comedy, actually, did you know Eddie growing up at all?
By Eddie, Sean is referring to Roosevelt, Long Island's own Eddie Murphy.
Because he grew up in Long Island, you know, neighboring towns.
I did not know Eddie personally. I played in bands at a club called Mr. Hicks Place in Roosevelt, Long Island during the early 80s, like around 1980, 81. Just as he's rising up doing comedy. So there was one night, I believe, that he went up and did a couple of minutes. This is right before he goes on Saturday Night Live as sort of a semi-cast member. But I didn't know him personally. Of course, he did grow up directly with Hank and Chuck.
Mm-hmm. And another comedy icon from a previous generation you worked with and produced two or three albums with is Paul Mooney. Did you know him before you signed him to your label?
I knew of Paul Mooney from seeing him do stand-up on TV. And when he would be a part of productions for Robert Townsend on Townsend's HBO specials. But when I would work on projects, on film projects in Hollywood, mm-hmm. I would go to the Comedy Store. And Mooney would close each evening. And I just thought he was brilliant. I, in fact, didn't know why he hadn't become much bigger just based on seeing him in that setting. You know, after working with him and, you know, going through all of his material, I did see why, because, you know, it was quite biting and acerbic, mm-hmm. racially and otherwise.
Because I study white audience. You can laugh at anybody, because white folks can talk about, nigga, you'll laugh. And the minute it's about you, white, you get that fucking bag. That no sense of humor about yourself. Fuck you. You can be talked about too. This is America. Fuck you.
So, yeah, I fell in comedy love with Paul Mooney from like 1990 to 1992, and then signed him to Stepson Music, which was my joint venture label deal with Tommy Boy Music and the Warner Music Group that we launched around 1992.
Yeah. And, you know, listening to those records, and they are exactly like you said, very pointed. You know, at least the first one, Race, is in front of an audience, obviously, which I think is a good thing for most comedy records.
Make that nigger. Stop saying nigger.
One thing that stands out with him is the use of the N-word.
I say nigger all the time. I say nigger 100 times every morning. It makes my teeth white. Nigger, 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 nigger.
Which I know 5 years before doing that record, you had forbid Chuck from using on the first Public Enemy album, at least to hear you tell it. What flipped? Was it just that was such a central part of his act that there was no way you could take it out?
Yeah. I thought that his use of the N-word was artful and was a critical component of his expression, to the point where even though I don't really use the word and haven't really use the word, I always defended his use of it, because even when he stopped using it, I thought that some of the effect of his art and his statement, you know, may have been affected. Would I say it was negatively affected? Maybe so. I didn't think that his humor had the same punch and range when he did artfully use the word, to the point where it became absurd.
Right.
And I think even, you know, NWA is really the same way. I've heard Ren, you know, say the same thing, that, you know, we were saying nigga, nigga, nigga repeatedly just for purposes of absurdity. We didn't, you know, think anyone would take it seriously.
Right. So speaking of NWA, actually, one of the things that you lived through in the music industry was gangster rap, to the point where you, I think, co-produced and were a big voice in an MTV special on gangster rap, the kind of like, you know, what is going on with this, with the kids today and their gangster rap special, which was, you know, quite a blast to watch.
Is gangster rap determined by your dress, the songs you make, the album you make, the record company you're on, the town that you come from? These are all incredible variables that make it very hard for us to define what it is.
Taking it back to the very sort of essence of this discussion, what is gangster rap?
You know, to this day, I don't know. I guess a gangster who raps, someone who purposely wants to commit crimes through the use of music. I know that folks defined a certain era of hip hop where there are representations of crime, of gang life, of violence, of murder, of drug dealing as you know, gangster rap. And I understand that, you know, things do need categories, I think, and labels, just for purposes of simplification.
And purposes of TV specials.
And purposes of TV specials, like gangster rap on MTV. But that is oversimplification for what that period and that time of music represented. We were in a very, very challenging era. We're here in this city, New York City, in 1991, 1992, 2,200 folks had lost their lives to murder and violence on the streets of the city. The same things were happening across the nation in Los Angeles, in Detroit, in Chicago, in Cleveland. The music reflected what was at that point the fog of war going on in urban communities across the nation.
Yeah. And, you know, so by 01, maybe you are out of the business.
Out of the day-to-day music business, yes.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, I think some of the music supervising stuff kept going after that, but the day-to-day music business in 01, why?
I thought I had done all I could do. Had finished my relationship with Interscope Records and got bought out. The business was moving in a different direction by virtue of technology and Napster. I had developed a relationship with the business editor for The Hollywood Reporter, who suggested that I start developing relationships with investment bankers and investment firms, as they were the ones who would dictate the future of entertainment and technology. So I started attending these Bear Stearns media conferences and JP Morgan media conferences.
And you end up on the board of a venture company.
Yeah. I wound up actually on the board of a Canadian tech company called Fluid Music that provided marketing and distribution for all sorts of labels back in the early 2000s. Actually, Fluid Music became the digital rights controller for American Idol at the beginning. And, you know, they were publicly traded, actually, on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And then later on, that led to other relationships with different investment firms. And a year ago, I worked with a venture capital fund called Newark Venture Partners, a $50 million tech fund developed in Newark, New Jersey, to essentially grow opportunity through tech in underserved communities like Newark.
Yeah, I would say you've been very involved in Newark politics, even though you don't live in Newark.
Yeah, I live in New Jersey, and you know, I felt the kinship to Newark early on when we moved out to Jersey. It's hard to get your streets fixed in Morris County, New Jersey. So you guys being Jersey guys.
Yeah.
So you got to get it where you can.
Right.
And, Newark,
the rough streets of Convent Station.
No, not the rough streets of Convent Station. It gets rough and rugged around, those universities around there.
And you did some government work for about 2 years on the U.S. Commission for Civil Rights.
Yes. I sat on the New Jersey Special Advisory Committee for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, analyzing civil rights issues critical to the state of New Jersey and also to the nation, and became chairman of that group from 2010 to 2012. It was a great experience.
What did you learn in your time?
We issued reports on civil rights issues related to education and for incarceration. Just analyzing different patterns on how young people are educated or not educated in New Jersey and across the nation, being connected to research that I wouldn't have been aware of had I not been a part of the committee, it became life-changing.
And you've also done a lot of work around fatherhood. You had the Families Organized for Liberty in Action. You've been involved with the National Fatherhood Initiative. So I guess, why is that such a passion?
I'm a dad. I had a dad. Probably the last generation, I am part of the last generation, along with Chuck, along with Harry Allen, along with Dr. Dre, along with Hank and Keith, of guys who were young black men who were born to two married parents, growing up in communities where the majority of African Americans and those families were headed by two married parents. After our generation, those circumstances changed. And my view is that the stable relationships that many of us were connected to, were raised by, gave us the opportunity to develop hip-hop and music in the way that we did, that there are so many other young people who are not afforded just that openness, man, just that nurturing, and that nurturing can be encouraged by having parents who are getting along, raising their kids in a healthy, cooperative fashion.
Yeah. And I read something you said once about sort of connecting integration, the demand for integration, kind of a militant posture of integration, and sort of the disillusion of family.
Yeah, integration may have played a role with destabilizing black communities, because the idea shouldn't have been, coming out of the civil rights movement, that all institutions owned, run by African Americans in Harlem, in Brooklyn, in Mobile, Alabama, in Hayti, North Carolina, those should be dismantled and everybody should go work and live with white people. First off, that's just another version of subjugation, just a better version. Why couldn't it have been for true integration? Certainly some can go live and work wherever they want to live and work, and that's fine. And there shouldn't be barriers to anybody doing anything in life. But why couldn't it have also been in the 60s, 70s, encouraging white kids to go to Howard University? Why did it have to be Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron just playing on white-owned teams, playing for Branch Rickey and the O'Malleys? Why couldn't some of the Mickey Mantle, play for Louis Armstrong's Negro League team? That would have created, I think, a better institutional balance rather than the institutional decimation that happened in places like here in Harlem, where functioning schools, functioning businesses in places that, yes, were racially segregated, were nonetheless functioning. As they became abandoned, a vacuum happens, and the economy suffers, the structure of the community suffers, and then the families suffer at the same time.
And so what is Bill Stefney up to now?
Bill Stefney is working as a principal for Broad Market Media, which is a production and consulting firm for tech companies, for media companies. We have all sorts of clients ranging from the New Jersey Performing Arts Center to ESPN to Morgan Stanley, advising them on everything from event production, diversity and inclusion strategies, business development strategies. Wherever we think we can be useful based on our experience, we try our best.
And you're on the board of the Little Theater a couple blocks north of here too.
I was on the board of the Apollo Theater Foundation.
Yeah,
but you do your homework. But you're a Berkeley guy, so you do your homework, right? You Berkeley guys do your stuff. Yeah. Do you recall a group called Fatbag that came out of Berkeley
actually,
in Boston? I signed them to Stepson.
That's amazing. They were there 90s. When I was there.
Yeah. Alexander Flamer. Alexander Flamer and Adam Deitch, who's gone on to be a great drummer. Those were all Berkeley guys.
Amazing. I haven't heard that name in a zillion years.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, all the way from Boston, here are Fatbag.
After the episode, Bill sent over this clip of Fatbag performing on the pilot of Chris Rock's HBO show. We'll link to it in the show notes.
Possible love, round the corner, do you want to go there? Find out, do you want a high side of your mind in your bad times? Reminiscence over you all day, all night.
And, speaking of college, the one thing I wanted to wind down with was going back to the Adelphi days. What was Baba Booey like when he was in college?
Baba Booey. The same. The same. Gary Delabate.
Adelphi University alum Gary Delabate, better known to Howard Stern fans as Baba Booey, has been the executive producer of Stern's show since 1984.
He, very much like me, there were two guys at Adelphi in the early 80s who were both working in professional radio while they were attending school. So there's me through my scholarship. Mm-hmm. And then there was Gary, who was working as a production assistant at WNBC, when this crazy guy, also from Roosevelt, Long Island, named Howard Stern, starts to blow up.
Wow. I don't think that I remembered Howard Stern was from Roosevelt.
Howard Stern was from Roosevelt, Long Island, and he would tell great jokes about getting his behind kicked to the point where his family had to move to nearby Rockville Center, Long Island, which is the all-white town right next to Roosevelt.
Right. Amazing. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on. It was great to have you and one step closer to our, Def Jam Volume 1 collection being complete.
Great to be here. Thank you, Sean.
Much like when I spoke to his old friend Keith Shockley, I loved talking to Bill about his experience with my personal favorite production team, the Bomb Squad. But that was only a small part of what was fascinating about the conversation. From the golden age of New York radio, to the scene at Adelphi, to Def Jam, to movies, and beyond, it was incredible for me to hear about the entirety of what Bill has been through. And I hope it was for you as well. Join us next week when we'll have the return of DJ EFN. Since the last time we talked to him, he's been busy making music, finishing up a movie,
And, oh yeah, creating the most popular hip-hop podcast in the world, Drink Champs. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our interview with another Adelphi alum, Dr. Dre of Yo MTV Raps fame, on episode 185. If you use iTunes, it's incredibly important to give us a rating and a review. It helps bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, you would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share bonus material that sometimes comes up when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of April to get access to May's file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
Yeah, I wanted to be a radio star.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I must be dreaming or, you know, hallucinating. Maybe it's the Chipwich.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Boundless energy, enthusiasm, and optimism.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I'm always amazed at just how his mind works.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Adam Silverstein.
I don't think it was warranted.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Should have been around all the rappers all that time.